KCAW Sitka, the House Jacks.
Richard Nelson for Encounters, a program of observations, experiences, and reflections on the world around us. Hey, do you know this sound? That muffled drumming sound is a classic anthem of springtime here in the northern forests of North America. It's always the same pattern. Starts kind of slow, a few little drum beats, and accelerates to a whirring blur, and then fairly quickly stops. And it's going to be repeated. You almost feel this rather than hear it. It's as if the sound is coming somehow from inside your own body. There's no other sound like this one. And if you grew up in the North Country, it probably stirs deep feelings for the mystique of wild places. Well, this is the drumming of the male ruffed grouse, signaling other males that this is his mating territory. And he's also advertising himself to females, saying, "Well, I'm available for mating. Come on over. Let's get acquainted." Well, I'm in. He's only about 30 feet away from me right now. Drumming grouse can be wary and hard to approach, and I'm not sure how he feels about the sound of my voice here. He's standing absolutely elegant looking at me. If you're lucky enough to see one of these birds, usually it's in shady or dappled forest, and that's where we are right now, right at the edge of this big stand of beautiful white-trunked aspen trees. The ruffed grouse's performance is often done on top of a fallen log, but it can happen in other places too, sometimes on top of a big rock, a dirt mound, a snowbank, even a rock wall or a culvert. Our grouse has chosen as his stage a low mound that's almost like a fallen log, actually, a bit of a berm here at the edge of the woods, and it's got gravelly dirt and moss covering it, so it must feel to him about the same as a log. The drumming that our grouse is doing is part of an elaborate display. The grouse often will strut back and forth on the log. Ours has been standing pretty still here for the past hour or so as I've been watching him. When he gets ready to drum, he leans forward, droops his wings, and he spreads his tail out in a wide arcing fan. It looks a bit like a Japanese paper fan, and it's highlighted elegantly by a conspicuous dark band along the outer rim of that arc. And as he does this, he fluffs out a ruff of very black feathers around his neck. It looks vaguely like one of those airline pillows, or maybe like one of those fancy collars worn by a Victorian English queen when he spreads it out as he has right now. And that ruff is where the ruffed grouse gets its name. I'm in a big forest of aspen trees in the interior of Alaska in the valley of the Tanana River. When I look off toward the south, through the still open leafless aspen trees, I should say they're starting to leaf out just now. It's fairly early spring. Looking off through the trees, I can see in the distance the high snow-covered peaks of the Alaska Range, stunning against the sky here this morning. It's a chilly morning, breezy, I'm pretty well bundled up here. There's been a lot of mosquitoes out here, the ones that hibernate through the winter, the big ones. And a few of the migratory birds coming in, you can hear in the background, ruby-crowned kinglet at intervals. There have been some white-crowned sparrows here, and the sandhill cranes are migrating, along with the great long skeins of tundra swans. Gorgeous time of year as the North Country starts burgeoning with life. Now our grouse, he's standing erect, and as he prepares to drum again, he will brace his tail on that drumming platform of his, drape his wings at his sides, and then here he goes. Rapidly accelerates to that flurry of high-speed thumping, and when he's in the middle of it, his wings are completely blurred. You can hardly even see him. Those broad, cupped wings of his, fairly short wings, as he does that, looks like he's gonna take off and start flying, but he's leaned way back with his chest out. The wings don't hit his chest, and they don't hit each other. That sound that we're hearing comes just from the wings hitting the air, and the sudden compression and release causes a flurry of little sonic booms, about 50 high-speed wing beats in each of those ethereal percussive rolls. It's as if this sound is coming from an instrument that's made somehow out of clouds. Then he stops, he leans forward, and he shows off again that fanned tail. Now on the underside of his tail, as he displays it here, is the most extraordinary thing. Hidden from view almost all the time, except when he wants to show it off, there's a little field of russet feathers, each one with an ivory-colored crescent on it. Just magical-looking thing, revealed during these moments when the male ruff grouse decides that he wants to show off everything he's got. Standing tall now, looking proud and self-satisfied after that riff of drumming that he's just done. That drumming carries a long ways through the forest. Researchers who study bird songs and bird sounds have discovered that birds that call from the ground, like our ruffed grouse, tend to make lower-pitched sounds. Those sounds carry farther than high-pitched sounds do. Well, the ruff grouse belongs to a big family of birds that includes many other species of grouse here in North America and in other parts of the world. The ptarmigan, the American turkey, the pheasants, the partridges, the guinea fowl. They're also related to peacocks and even to chickens. Actually, when you look at our grouse here, he looks a little bit like a chicken, although I wouldn't want to carry that one too far. He's more compact. He's got a shorter neck, shorter legs, and man, I gotta guess the grouse is way smarter than a chicken. Although, no offense now to those of you who are chicken owners and chicken fans out there. Here in Alaska, ruff grouse live along the valleys of the big rivers. Ruff grouse are also found clear across Canada and south in the Rocky Mountains as far as Colorado and in the Appalachian Mountains south to northern Georgia. That's the unmistakable clattering calls of a flock of sandhill cranes. Where are they? Oh, right there. Great, long, winding skein of them into a broad V shape, now kind of morphing into a great open crescent of sandhill cranes flying straight overhead. I'm going to guess there's about 150 of them in that group, and I can see another one off in the distance. Great flying crosses, these birds, their wings, I suppose, spanning about 5 feet, their necks outstretched, their legs stretched out behind them, headed for their nesting grounds in subarctic Alaska and Canada, and some of them even cross over the Bering Strait and do their nesting over in western Siberia, the sandhill cranes. Oh, our ruff grouse is in full display again with his tail fanned out, turning toward me and strutting a little bit in this direction. There's a kind of a schizophrenic side to the lives of every grouse species. Each one of them has a time for gaudy, noisy, conspicuous mating displays like the one we're seeing right now. But the rest of the time, they blend cryptically and quietly into their surroundings. Our ruffed grouse come in two color phases, grayish-brown or reddish-brown. Our guy here is the gray kind, and that's most common in the North Country, perhaps because that plumage color blends in better with the snow. Oh, here he goes drumming again. Now, as I look closely, he's all mottled with flecks and spots and stripes against that background of light gray color. It's an excellent camouflage. When this guy moves off his little breeding platform here down into this leafy gray forest floor, he absolutely disappears. It's quite extraordinary to see. And of course, they spend quite a bit of time in the heavy thickets where it's difficult to see him. This is a bird that scrupulously avoids being in plain sight, except for this time of year when he gets out here and he's making a statement. Here I am, everybody. Take a look. How about this? Well, our ruffed grouse, they spend their lives in fairly small home territories. These birds also don't migrate. Our grouse has been in this area all year round. They stay at home, like the ravens, like the gray jays, like the chickadees, that also are the winter stalwarts. Now, from here in the spring all the way through summer and into fall, the diet of the ruffed grouse mainly seeds, berries, fruits, leaves, also insects. And then in winter, they feed mainly on buds and twigs of aspen trees like the ones around us right now, favorite habitat for ruffed grouse, also birch and willow. And they'll also find berries like the lowbush cranberries that stay all the way through winter and freeze solid. Ruffed grouse will find them down there and feed on those. Our grouse now turning and facing toward me. He's been faced away, going into another little full display. I can see his three big forward-facing toes. There's another interesting thing that happens with those toes during the wintertime. The ruffed grouse is adapted for walking on fluffy, powdery, soft winter snow. In the fall time, they grow small comb-like projections along both sides of those toes. And this helps to keep them from sinking down into the snow, sort of like snowshoes. And then those little projections are shed again in the springtime. Looking at our grouse now, wow, he is really puffed up. Does he see something back there in the woods? He's looking back straight away. Maybe there's another male back there, or dare I dream that a female would be coming to test out his romantic affections. Oh man, is he ever displaying right now? The drumming peaks around sunrise and sunset. It's pretty early in the morning right now here. And then this drumming will happen every few minutes. Occasionally, they'll drum all the way through the day. Ours seems to do that. Sometimes also on moonlit nights. We're almost at the full moon right now. The drumming is most intense when there's another male in the area. They'll duel back and forth in response to each other. Sometimes the challenger moves closer. He might even imitate the other guy's drumming pattern. So they have kind of sound battles between male ruffed grouse. The competitors are also face off against each other, spread the neck ruff, spread out the tail. They'll strut, they'll hiss, they'll chase each other around, but they seldom actually fight with each other. Now, I've moved within about 15 feet of our grouse, and he is absolutely at the peak of display, his feathers puffed out everywhere, looking over his shoulder toward me, facing away from me, tail fanned and erect to show that marvelous spread of brown feathers under his tail, shaking his head, shaking that ruff, strutting now one direction and another. And if we listen very closely now, you'll hear him. He's walking through the dry leaves, strutting in those leaves, making noise. He stops He's pecking the ground, which he does when he's pretty agitated. Down in the dry leaves again. I think I'm going to back off a little bit here. He is enacting exactly what he does if another grouse is bugging him and he's being antagonistic. So they will do this. We've proved it right now, as the experts say that they'll display when a human comes too close, as well as another grouse. The male's goal and desire here is to attract a female to his drumming spot, impress her by this strutting display of feathery grandeur that we're seeing right now. And then, of course, if he's lucky, she's going to want to mate with him. Now, I got to say, monogamy is not one of the big virtues in rough grouse society. Both the males and the females may have multiple springtime trysts. Well, in any case, the female makes her nest on the ground. It's a little depression lined with soft vegetation. And in matters of family life, she's totally on her own. Our beautiful grouse, for all his glory, I'm afraid he's a deadbeat dad. He's going to be long gone by the time that brood is born. He takes no part in raising the chicks. Well, it's usually a pretty big clutch of eggs, around 8 to 14 of them. Rough grouse need to have lots of young because many of them are not going to survive. In fact, the majority won't survive. Rough grouse chicks are born highly developed, unthinkably cute little downy puffballs they are, instinctively imprinted on their mother, so they follow her everywhere. She leads them off like a little feathery parade through the forest. She takes them to thick cover where they're less likely to be found by predators, and she'll brood them during the nighttime to keep them warm. She's a doting mother, takes good care of her little family. There he goes again. The chicks eat on their own. They grow quickly. They start flying within a week of coming out of the egg, so they develop very fast. Well, it's a dangerous world here. There's lots of predators looking for the eggs, looking for the chicks, hunting for adults. I've seen around this spot tracks of coyote, tracks of fox, tracks of wolves. Besides those animals, predators on grouse include mink and weasel, the lynx, hawks, owls. Now, when an adult grouse sees a predator nearby, it'll hunker down or it'll duck for cover. A female with her eggs or chicks is likely to do something different. She'll feign a broken wing and go flapping off to try to lure that predator away. Now, in spite of all these dangers, the rough grouse is a very successful bird in the North American boreal forest. This doesn't mean that they're always common. The boreal forest is famous for cyclic changes that happen in some of the wildlife populations. That includes the rough grouse, which cycles from abundance through scarcity over periods of about 10 years. In fact, over the past 40 years here in interior Alaska, peak numbers of rough grouse have come in the latter part of each decade. Now, why do these regular cycles happen? The answer is a fascinating example of the way animals and their environments are intricately braided together. Let me explain this. The snowshoe hare, small rabbit that changes color from brown in the summer to white in the winter, is another ubiquitous small animal in the boreal forest. We've got them all around here. The snowshoe hare goes through dramatic population cycles about every 8 to 11 years. Those cycles probably related to the dynamics between snowshoe hares and their food supplies. Now, snowshoe hares can become incredibly abundant. When that happens, you can see it. The shrub thickets full of white trunks and branches where the bark has been gnawed off by those prolific hares. Then what happens? The population crashes, snowshoe hares suddenly rare. Predators like lynx, goshawks, great horned owls that I've been hearing the last few nights had become abundant, feasting on all those snowshoe hares. Now those predators are facing an extreme scarcity of food. What do? They shift to other prey, and that includes the ruffed grouse. And as a result, ruffed grouse numbers fall dramatically. Then some years later, the snowshoe hare population increases again. Predators focus their attention back on the hares, less on the grouse, and the rough grouse population grows. So the population cycles of ruffed grouse lag behind the cycles of snowshoe hares and the related ebb and flow of the predators. Interestingly, in some places down in the lower 48 United States, places that have no snowshoe hares, ruffed grouse populations are not cyclic. So there's strong evidence for the validity of that interplay. It reminds me of something written by John Muir. He said, "When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe." Back in the last century, ruffed grouse populations fell dramatically in much of the northern United States and southern Canada, but for totally different reasons from these cycles we've been talking about. From around 1850 into the early 1900s, there was massive unregulated hunting for all sorts of game. Partly that was for subsistence, but mostly it was commercial hunting for the meat markets, for the restaurants. Well, ruffed grouse were among the species that were targeted by that market hunting. Grouse at the same time were impacted by the cutting of forests for timber and the clearing of land for agriculture. Well, not surprisingly, what happened was widespread scarcity or the complete disappearance of grouse from parts of North America. Then, new game laws were enacted, closed seasons, bag limits, and at the same time, young regrowing forests, like this beautiful forest of white-trunked aspens we're in this morning, those forests regrew and the ruffed grouse found ideal habitat, populations rebounded. When hunting is well managed, hunting is not a key factor in grouse populations. It was only because it was so extreme back during that era of market hunting. Numbers of grouse rise and fall today according to bigger processes, natural cycles, land development, logging and regrowth of forest, forest fires. So today the ruffed grouse is an important game species in much of Canada and in many parts of the northern United States, plus, of course, here in Alaska. Here in Alaska, there's an interesting project to establish a brand new population of ruffed grouse in a couple of places near the city of Anchorage, and along with that project to open the forest and to create these young stands of aspen that are so ideal for ruffed grouse. Key partner in that project, an organization called the Ruffed Grouse Society. It's a national hunters organization. Reminds me that people who don't hunt often fail to understand how deeply many hunters feel about wildlife and wild country, how much they love the outdoors. One of the greatest of all American hunter conservationists was Aldo Leopold. Aldo Leopold was a man who was captivated by the ruffed grouse. In his famous and beautiful book, A Sand County Almanac, Aldo Leopold wrote this: "Everybody knows that the autumn landscape in the North Woods is the land plus a red maple plus a ruffed grouse. In terms of conventional physics, the ruffed grouse represents only a millionth of the mass or the energy of an acre. Yet subtract the ruffed grouse and the whole thing is dead. An enormous amount of some kind of motive power has been lost." Well, Aldo Leopold was writing about fall time in the state of Wisconsin. But I think as we watch and listen to this bird, I think we can feel the same kind of power of the ruffed grouse here in the burgeoning springtime of this Alaskan forest. Well, it's very important to remember, as our grouse strutting his stuff here, that the power and the beauty of the ruffed grouse has been recognized by people since a time long before Aldo Leopold wrote those words, probably since a time when the very first Native American people set up their camps in the forests of Ice Age North America. And still today, in many Native American and First Nations communities, ruffed grouse remains an important source of food, a part of the subsistence lifeway, and a being and a personage in a community of life to which the people themselves belong. I was able to learn a little bit about this as a student and apprentice with Koyukon Indian people in their villages near the Arctic Circle here in interior Alaska. Well, the Koyukon elder, Catherine Atla, who's one of the most important teachers in my life, once told me an ancient sacred story, the kind of stories called Qadonsidni in the Koyukon language, a story about the ruffed grouse. There was a group of women back in that time when the animals and the people lived together who wanted to pick berries over on the other side of a river. Well, of course, along came the godlike trickster raven, and he said, oh, I'll take you across the river in my canoe, one at a time. Well, he did that. He took all the older women first, and he kept making one young girl wait until the last. When they got out on the river with the young girl, he said, oh, I'm so tired. I can't keep paddling. I have to rest. And then he let his canoe drift downstream away from the other women. Well, the young woman could see that something was going on here. And so she said, oh, I have to go on shore. I'll just be a minute. I have to do something on shore here. Well, Raven argued with her and finally relented, let her off his canoe. She said, oh, I'll come right back. Well, of course, when she got ashore, she ran off and she didn't come back. Well, the raven tried to give chase, but the young woman had been clever enough to very quickly sew the raven's shirt onto the cross piece of his canoe. He jerked, he pulled, he tugged. He got angrier and angrier, and finally he pulled the cross piece right off his canoe, and away he went chasing the girl. Well, the young girl had hidden herself up in one of those elevated log caches that you see today in Athabascan Indian villages around interior Alaska. Raven finally came to that log cache, looked up through the cracks in the logs, and started poking his spear up through those cracks again and again. And finally, blood came dripping and leaking down through the cracks between the logs. The angry raven poked again and again. More and more blood came down. Then that young girl was transformed into the ruffed grouse, and she flew away to safety. That's why, ever since, the ruffed grouse has whitish-colored meat, because that young girl had lost so much blood before she was transformed into ruffed grouse. Well, ever since I heard that story, it's been about 30 years ago now, I've always felt something ancient and timeless whenever I see Tsongada, the ruffed grouse, or whenever I hear this foggy, ethereal, directionless, percussive sound drifting off through the wilds of the northern forest. Our ruff grouse now, tail fanned, the ruff around his neck puffed out, his whole body expanded to seems like twice normal size, the little crest on top of his head erect, looking over his shoulder toward me. What a pleasure to spend time with this bird who's been so patient and tolerant of a guy hanging around with him the last few days. Well, for Encounters, I'm Richard Nelson. I want to thank you so much for your good company. And do I ever owe a word of thanks to this ruffed grouse. We'll see you next time.
Encounters is a production of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska. The program was written and narrated by Richard Nelson, and produced by Lisa Bush with help from Holly Keene. Special consulting from Ken Fate. Theme music by Outback. Encounters is funded during the International Polar Years by the National Science Foundation and by the Kenneth Johnson Family Foundation, Robert Osborne, Jerry Tone, Martha Wyckoff, and Sue Cohn. For more information about the show and how to get copies, visit us online at encountersnorth.org.
You are listening to Raven Radio, KCAW Sitka, with translators K288CZ Angoon, K296CX Cake, K211BY Yakutat, K211EP Elfin Cove, K220BR Tenneke Springs, K220CH Port Alexander, K219BA Pelican, and K211BG Sitka. Raven Radio is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by members like you.
Ain't there nothing that can take us to relieve this pain? get this straight. Put the lime in the coconut, you drag the boat up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drag the boat up. Put the lime in the...
Welcome, everyone, to KCAW Sitka. This is Raven Radio, and my name is Martha Pearson. I am your host for Health Chat. For the next half hour, we'll be discussing health and health-related issues on Health Chat. Today, the guest is Dr. Don Teeter, who is a physician who works in Southeast Alaska. Thank you, Dr. Teeter, so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me, Martha.
So, I know you've been a physician for many years. Tell us a little bit about yourself and the specialty area that you are currently in.
All right. So, I historically am a family doctor. I did my residency in family medicine way back in the 1980s, and I practiced in a small town in the western mountains of North Carolina for 25 years. I had a small solo practice. My wife is a behavioral health specialist, and she was in the practice with me, so it was just the two of us and four other employees.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had a really good practice. It was just an exciting time, and I think we provided good medical care to our patients. In the southern Appalachian Mountains where we were located, we began to see a lot of people develop addiction to the opioids back in the early 2000s. And I had actually helped start and was working part-time at a free clinic in the community as well. And in particular, at the free clinic, we're beginning to see a lot of people who are addicted to opioids were asking for help. And you know, it's just... addiction is hard to treat anyway, but the addiction to opioids is especially hard to treat. So about that time, a medication called buprenorphine got approved for treatment of people with addiction to opioids, and I got certified to prescribe that. I was one of the first people in the western part of the state to do it, and our practice was just overwhelmed with people coming in for help. It was really just very enlightening to me to hear their stories, to find out how they got addicted. I realized that most of them got addicted from me and my colleagues prescribing too many opioids or prescribing opioids when non-opioid medication should have been used.
Mm-hmm.
And their addiction started from that prescription. So then I became more interested in learning, you know, how should we be treating pain? And, you know, the really interesting thing is, as big a problem as pain is in the United States and as big a problem as addiction is in the United States, we just don't get much education in that in the medical community. We don't know much about those things. So for many years, my patients with chronic pain were my most difficult patients. I didn't like seeing them because I didn't really know what to do for them. I didn't feel I was helping them. They were reaching out and, you know, just crying for some kind of relief from their pain. And I just wasn't doing anything to help them. You know, we give them various medications. In the 1990s and early 2000s, we started giving them opioids, and many people, their pain got worse on that. So anyway, I had to learn a lot of this stuff on my own. Actually went back to school at night at the University of North Carolina to get a master's in public health. And when I did that, I had access to their medical library, and I just really read a lot about this stuff. And I learned all kinds of things that I never knew. And suddenly it made sense. It made sense to me why, you know, people were getting addicted to the opioids we were giving them, why their pain was getting worse oftentimes, why I couldn't help them at all. And I decided, you know, I need to help educate other people about that. So my specialty focus changed from family medicine to just doing pain and addiction treatment about 5 years ago.
Fantastic. And it seems particularly interesting to me that you and your spouse were working together, she from a behavioral health component and you from a physical, you know, a more family practice component. And I imagine you were seeing a lot of the same families, a lot of the same people and dealing with a lot of the same problems. Is that true?
That's true. So, you know, we've been real proponents for the integrated care model of medicine where you have behavioral health together with primary care providers to provide kind of a holistic treatment of whatever their disease is, whether it's addiction or pain or diabetes or hypertension. It was a really, really good model for family medicine because it was a small practice. Many times our patients would call up and whoever answered the phone, whatever one of our employees answered the phone, they would know who it was just by their voice. They'd know their history, you know, they knew what they need to worry about and what they didn't, maybe what was really bothering them. So anyway, we we think we provided a very high level of care to these folks. And I really believe integrated care medicine is just, it's the ideal model for primary care.
Yeah, it does sound really effective. And lucky for those patients that you were able to treat and work with, work alongside, really,
right.
You know, as you were practicing back in North Carolina. So here you are now in Alaska, and the opioids are prescribed with good intention most of the time. You can assume that, but an addiction evolves, and then you have a situation that almost is worse than the patient who came to you initially for pain. You know, we all know what pain is. We know what pain is from the time we're babies. But what's really happening in our brain? How does something like an opioid fix that or seem to fix it?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is we all kind of have our own impression of what pain is. Mm-hmm. And as medical providers, we do too. We were really taught of pain as this very linear process where you stub your toe, the inflammation or injury to the toe activates your pain nerve fibers that transmit the pain signal. It transmits the signal all the way up to the top of your brain. An area on the top of your brain is called the somatosensory cortex. And when those nerves are activated, it's when we actually feel pain, right? So we were taught this very linear pathway.
Mm-hmm.
A neurosurgeon can keep you awake and can open up your skull and have access to that area of the brain and can touch it with an electrode, and it'll make your foot hurt if he touches it in the region that innervates the foot. Or he can touch another area and make your hip hurt. So it's these cells in the brain, when they're activated, that's when we feel the pain. That's that physical sensation of pain. But there's a whole lot that goes on before that that I wasn't taught about. We didn't even really know about it 20 years ago. Now, starting 20 years ago, we started to learn this stuff, but we haven't done very good teaching medical professionals. But what we now know is that pain isn't so much this linear pathway, but that pain is really kind of this danger signal. And its purpose is to make us pay attention to whatever's happening so that we can avoid the danger. And oftentimes, if there's trauma, say, to your foot, right, you want to avoid more trauma to the foot, and you want to behave in a way that helps the foot heal up faster. So our brain, our central nervous system, actually is not this linear pathway where it goes straight to the somatosensory cortex, but it sends the signal to many areas of the brain. And these areas of the brain make this interpretation on how dangerous it is. And then they send a signal back that either magnifies that so we pay more attention to it, or it diminishes it so we don't feel as much attention to it. So this is kind of the brain's control. It's like it has like a volume knob over how much we feel pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be so significant now that we know that people can feel severe pain when there's no tissue damage or injury at all. And conversely, it's well known that soldiers in the battlefield can have a gunshot wound, say, to their shoulder or even their abdomen, and not feel it for up to an hour later because their brain has turned off that pain signal, so they don't feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they need to react to other stuff, and they need to get out of danger first. So our brain is very powerful in being able to turn the volume way up or way down. And that works great for acute pain, right? So we respond to it in a way that helps. But for chronic pain, it ends up that we respond to it in a way that doesn't work, and it actually makes the pain worse in the long term. So as we're learning all of this, we're learning different ways, that different things we can do to help control that process to decrease somewhat that sensation of pain.
So this volume control is very interesting, and I'm imagining now that you're working with patients, and all of us would be smart to attempt to control our own volume, if you will. Like, you know, when you stub your toe or bump into a dresser or whatever it is, to think about, okay, that was a warning signal. And just to sort of practice on little things like that, because as we age, as things happen, we might very well be in a situation where we have a chronic pain situation due to deteriorating joints or ligaments or just aging or a medical condition that also makes a person experience a lot of damage to their body and the pain that comes from it. Am I going down the right pathway at all?
Yeah.
Or am I just making stuff
up.
Okay,
really
good.
Are.
Okay, so you know, I'm liking the idea of how could we practice on this volume control idea, and I'd love for you to say more about that.
So you can practice several ways. So first of all, there's what they call mindfulness, which is this technique where you focus on different things, and there's a number of different ways to do mindfulness. Your folks that are listening in the radio can look this up, but it's a way to kind of focus on where you are now and what's happening. So say you have, even maybe you had surgery on maybe a broken bone in your leg, right? And now you're in the post-op unit at the hospital and the pain's really bad. Well, when you practice mindfulness, you come to this real calm place, and it slows your heart rate down. It slows all those signals down going back and forth between your brain and your leg. You recognize that your leg hurts, but you focus on it in a way that you don't respond to it. So you don't freak out, right? You don't get all excited. You don't have this fear response that is supposed to increase your pain. So you can kind of calm your body down. And there's some mindfulness works for a lot of things. It works for anxiety. It works for insomnia. So there's a lot of things where we can actually physically kind of slow our brain down and slow all those transmissions down and slow down whatever sensations we're feeling. So it's really easy to find some mindfulness exercises on the internet that you can do, and that works real fast. So you can teach that to somebody after they wake up after surgery, and they can start practicing it, and immediately, you know, their blood pressure goes down, and they still feel the pain, but they don't respond to it so much. And because of that, then their brain starts turning that volume down a little bit. Now, none of this stuff that we do with our minds turn the volume off, right? We're going to still feel the pain. Mm-hmm. But the key is to learn to accept that pain and to live despite that pain, whether it's acute or chronic. And by doing that, again, your brain turns that volume down a little bit so it doesn't bother you as much.
Mm-hmm. So you have you had patients that actually lived with what would typically be a very painful condition with very little medication or maybe even no medication just because they were able to control that volume?
Yes, and you know that a lot of people can, they just kind of naturally do that. So our response to pain is partially learned. It's stuff we learned from our parents when we were kids and how they reacted to pain. Some of it is actually genetic. I mean, there's some genetic characteristics you can inherit that might make you feel more or less pain. So some of it is kind of inherited. So I like to talk about my grandmother, my dad's mom. She was 80 years old when I was born, right? So she was almost 50 when he was born, and he was in his late 30s. So she was 80 years old when I was born. She lived all of her life on a little small 60-acre farm in rural Kentucky, growing and raising everything they ate. Mm-hmm. So they worked from sun up to sundown, and she had horrible arthritis of her hips and knees and her shoulders. And so I remember her, she could barely walk. You know, she died when I was like 7 years old, but I still remember her these last few years of her life with a cane, barely able to walk. And yet she never complained. She was never depressed. She was happy about spending time with family. She was happy with living on the farm still. And all of this was kind of the way she was brought up, where you beat the pain, right? It happens, that's a part of life, but it's not going to make me depressed, and it's not going to make me anxious.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of how she learned from her family and even probably from the generation of her time that they did that. Our society has changed since then, and that pain is not a normal part of life now. We try to avoid pain at all costs. We think we ought to get whatever medications we can to avoid that pain. And what we know now, some of those medications made the pain worse in the long term. And some of that thinking, that kind of mindset that pain is the enemy and, you know, it makes us miserable. Just by thinking that, it makes our pain feel worse.
Mm-hmm. I like what you said earlier, too. Pain is a danger warning. It's as mm-hmm. if you have somebody saying, hey, stop doing that. You know, go this way, not that way. It's just a danger warning. It isn't something that is going to last forever in many cases.
Right.
And mm-hmm. it is just a signal that you can heed and move on.
I'll just share a personal story while we're talking about this. So I've really, you know, I've worked exclusively in this area for the past 5 or 6 years or so. And before that, somewhat in that area, but 15, 20 years ago, I didn't know hardly any of this stuff. And I have Crohn's disease. And there was times when the pain from that was so bad, the pain in my abdomen was so bad that I thought I would die from the pain,
mm-hmm.
right? I thought, there's no way I can live through this. And that very thinking, that catastrophizing, that negative thinking makes the pain worse and it makes the pain last longer. But it's kind of a normal reaction, again, kind of based on what we've, you know, kind of our society and what we accept and what we don't accept. So back then, pain was the enemy. You know, I didn't see it as a warning sign. And I always did live through it, right? It got better after a while from various things. But I remember that feeling very well, thinking, I just cannot live through this. I'm going to die from this pain.
Mm-hmm. Because in that moment, it seemed like that. But
yeah.
It was your brain telling you that as well.
Exactly right. And so if I knew this then, I could have practiced that mindfulness right away. And again, the pain wouldn't have gone away, but I would have been able to bear it better. And by doing that, I would have felt it a little bit less.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to Health Chat. This is Martha Pearson, your host. And my guest today is Dr. Don Teeter, who specializes in pain management, and helping his patients navigate whatever it is they need to navigate, whether they're healing from a surgery or an accident, whether they have a chronic condition. If it involves pain, helping them to manage that as effectively as possible. Dr. Teeter, you've spoken with us about mindfulness as a way of understanding and seeing pain as a brain reaction and a warning sign, and some strategies for working with whatever pain we might have. And we've also been discussing how pain is, the attitude toward pain is something that is socially influenced. You know, if you're raised to believe that pain is the enemy and something that must be eradicated, that makes a difference compared to someone who was raised to believe that pain is part of being human and it is something that is going to just be part of a day and doesn't deserve center place. Hope I was able to capture that well enough. Please rephrase if I missaid anything. But
I think that's great. I think that's really important. And I will tell you, of the pain patients, of the patients I see now with chronic pain, some of them have kind of realized, yeah, I can go on with this, and it's not going to destroy me. And they still have pain, and they still have struggles at sometimes in their life. I mean, it doesn't make everything great.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a higher quality of life than those people who just think that their life is miserable. They become depressed. They become anxious. They kind of give up on trying.
Mm-hmm.
People that kind of get to that stage, their quality of life is significantly worse. So a lot of times, you know, our goal in treating people with chronic pain at Search, I work for Search, our goal treating them is not to take away their pain, because there is no cure for chronic pain. But our goal is to really make their life better, help them make their life better. So that's another thing that I really try to reinforce, is that people with chronic pain, if their pain and their life is going to improve, it's really up to them more than it is up to me as the physician.
Mm-hmm.
They need to develop that attitude where they are going to fight this and they're going to do whatever they can to make their life better. They're going to start doing fun things again. They're going to start getting outside more. As they develop that attitude, then again, their life gets better. Although they may still have pain, it's not usually as significant, in particular as you're looking at their entire life situation.
That's fantastic news. And tell me, we spoke a little bit earlier about opioids and how you as a physician saw the negative effects of prescribing opioids as a way to alleviate pain and the patient eventually becoming addicted to them. Would it be fair to say that opioids represented at the time that sort of magic switch to make the pain go away, and it didn't prove to work out that way? Tell me more about how that worked.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me talk kind of about two situations. One is the acute pain situation, somebody that has a new injury or just had surgery. And the other is somebody with chronic pain where their pain has been going on for a long time.
Okay.
So in acute pain, we've always thought that opioids are these very safe medications. You know, they're the most powerful drugs we have for treatment of pain. And often my talks, I do a lot of education presentations for medical professionals. And a lot of times in my talks, I'll point out about how we're all taught that opioids are these powerful painkillers. Well, in fact, the science has shown that taking one over-the-counter ibuprofen, 200 milligrams, at the same time as you take one extra-strength Tylenol, you take the two over-the-counter pills together, mm-hmm. is 60% more effective at relieving pain than taking two Percocet pills together.
Wow.
So these over-the-counter medications are much more powerful at reducing pain, plus outcomes are better. So studies have also shown if you treat acute pain with an opioid, it doubles their risk of developing disability later on. It starts them towards this process of developing chronic pain. For a number of reasons, they do that. And the third thing is with the opioids is we now know from about six different studies that have come out looking at different groups of people that if you give an opioid for an acute pain problem like that, about 1 out of 20 people will remain on the opioids long term, either because their pain continues or something happens, but it does something in their brain that makes it so they have a harder time getting off of them. And their provider might prescribe them for a long time, or the provider might just do it for a week or two and stop, but then they start getting them from family and friends and then from other people that are selling them, and it kind of starts them down this road to addiction. Mm-hmm. So our acute pain treatment with opioids is not only less effective than the over-the-counter medicines, but it's more dangerous and has worse outcomes.
Right.
So that's one situation. The issue with chronic pain is a little different. So people that develop chronic pain, as I did in the past, is you tend to develop these negative thoughts, and we call that catastrophizing, where when your pain gets worse, you jump to the worst conclusion, and that causes you to develop anxiety. And over time, that causes depression to develop. So most people with chronic pain have some element of anxiety or depression. Well, what we know with the opioids is that even more than relieving pain, they relieve anxiety and depression immediately. So some of my patients that got addicted tell me that they say, you know, I had addiction my entire life, and my doc put me on Prozac and Paxil and Cymbalta and all these antidepressants, and they work a little bit, but the depression is still there. And then I took a Percocet one time, and my depression went away completely in 15 minutes.
Mm.
So for those people that already have depression, and those people with chronic pain with depression or anxiety, that goes away immediately. And so their mood is better, they're happier, they're happy maybe for the first time, but that effect wears off really quickly, and you have to take more opioids and more opioids, and as you develop the tolerance, the anxiety and the depression gets worse, to where after about a month, it's worse than it was before you started on it. And that anxiety and depression is driving some of that chronic pain, so their pain gets worse as well. So most of the studies that have looked at long-term treatment of chronic pain have shown that, you know, people that are on this long time, their pain gets worse, their anxiety gets worse, and their depression gets worse. But immediately, when they first started on it, it was great. But over time, that just wears off, and it actually causes a reversal in how they feel. So many people, but then when they try to stop, their anxiety and depression and pain get even worse. So they think they can't come off of it. So we kind of get in this trap where we've taken them as their providers. And as you said, it was done with good intentions because we were told these were good medications. But after a while of people being on them, you know, their pain is worse, their anxiety and depression is worse, their quality of life is worse. But when we try to reduce their opioids, it gets worse yet. So we kind of get in this situation that it becomes very difficult to treat.
That is really interesting, though, the effect it has. It tells you once again, though, that these medications are not treating the wound, or even, like, let's say a person has chronic pain because they have a disc in their back that is not behaving properly. Well, the opioid isn't working on the disc. It's working on their brain.
Right.
And mm-hmm.
And so the brain knows that, and it starts to respond after the very first dose. It starts to change things in the brain, like the opioid receptors. They go underneath the surface of the cell, so they won't work anymore. Mm. And they start making less endorphins, which are our own natural opioids. And so the brain begins with the first dose to try to compensate for that opioid that we're taking. And as time goes on, those changes become more and more. And there was a study done a few years ago by a doctor who had people go on opioids or ibuprofen for their back pain. He did an MRI of their brain at the beginning, and then he repeated it 1 month later. And people on opioids, he could measure changes that had occurred in the brain just by taking this picture with the MRI.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, these changes were in the same areas of the brain that we see with addiction. So the opioids actually, you know, change your brain in a way that, you know, starts you down this road to addiction. Now, not everybody on chronic opioids develops addiction, but they have a higher likelihood of developing that.
Right. It just seems like a dangerous a thing to go into if you don't have to. If you
right.
can manage it in other ways, that seems like a safer route to at least try initially for chronic
right.
pain. And
now I will tell you there are several instances when opioids are definitely indicated.
Yeah.
And one obviously is end of life. If people are dying and they have pain from cancer or whatever it is, even if they don't have cancer, maybe if they have a lot of anxiety, depression, these opioids for the last few months of life, you know, really give them a lot of relief because, again, they're very calming and they're pretty powerful antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're having pain, it will reduce that short term. So people end of life in hospice care, opioids are definitely indicated and, you know, there shouldn't be any restrictions or limits on that. The other situation we know is that people that have a severe trauma, severe physical trauma, like soldiers in a battlefield, they've done studies with them, and they've shown if they have a severe wartime injury, the sooner they get the morphine, the less likely they are to develop PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, that's felt not to be because of the pain-reducing properties, but because of the calming effects of opioids. Because PTSD is caused by looking down and seeing your leg is blown off, and immediately your adrenaline level goes to these super normal levels and your cortisol does all this and your heart rate goes up to 180 and you're just freaking out, which is a normal response. But that those levels of those chemicals cause damage in your brain that makes it so later on you can't control those memories and you get flashbacks. And you can't control the pain very well and you get chronic pain. And you have anxiety and you have all this stuff that kind of goes on. But if you can calm that down immediately with the morphine, then they're less likely to develop PTSD. And if they do develop it, it's less severe. So they've also shown that in severe burn patients, same thing. The sooner they get the morphine, the better their outcomes. But in burn patients, they found that if they continued the opioids for longer than 7 days, then the outcomes become worse. People develop more chronic pain. They have more depression, more anxiety that happens if it's gone longer than 7 days. So the goal is, even with severe trauma, that we use opioids initially, but we try to get people off and get them on alternatives within 7 days.
All of this is really interesting. Thank you so much for sharing, Dr. Teeter, your knowledge about pain management and particularly the use of opioids. As you know, it's a powerful tool, needs to be used carefully, but it sounds like there are definitely certain situations where it is the best choice.
Right.
And
you know, I will share one other time with you. I don't want to neglect this. People that become addicted to opioids, the best treatment is other opioids, in particular methadone and buprenorphine, or commonly mm-hmm. known as Suboxone, because they replace the endorphins that are missing in your brain. And for most people with opioid use disorder, with addiction to opioids, those endorphins never come back to normal, which makes it the hardest addiction to treat without medication.
Mm-hmm.
But with these medications, people get back to normal again. So it's really, I mentioned that I started doing that about 16 years ago in Western North Carolina using Suboxone or buprenorphine as the same medicine
mm-hmm.
to treat opioid use disorder. And I'm telling you, to see the changes in people's lives, that changed my life. That's mm-hmm. what got me interested in all of this, to see how people went from being the worst place in their life to being normal, getting their family back, getting their job back. And it's just this amazing thing to see, the most amazing thing I'd seen as a family practitioner. And I thought, I just got to do this all the time.
Yeah.
So they are opioids. It's not substituting one addiction for another. It's actually replacing the chemicals that are missing in the brain in a way that people feel normal. So it's pretty cool.
Excellent. That and it's so hopeful. It's so good to end on a hopeful message. This is Dr. Don Teeter talking with us about pain and pain management on Health Chat. Thank you for your time today, Dr. Teeter. We are going to wrap things up. We are at the end of our time, unfortunately. But it's been great having you on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Martha.
Put the lime in the coconut and call me in the morning. Ooh, ooh.